This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia. From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Danielle Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leon and written by Bettina Jilliwa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. My name is Dino Ray Ramos.
And I'm Amanda Nduka. And so for this podcast, we have another Insecure star. We've hosted a lot of Insecure stars on here. We know, you guys know we're big fans of the show. Kendrick Sampson, who plays—
Also fellow Texan, let's say that.
Who was Lyft Bay on Insecure. He's also very big on activism, which is, we talk about it during the podcast.
In depth.
Yeah. He was very vocal about Black Lives Matter. He's out on the front lines protesting every day. And we had a really great conversation about what's going on in the community, what's going on in the entertainment community, what's going on just in the community at large. I mean, he had so much knowledge about stuff, and it's just really interesting. We learned really interesting things from him.
And I think what's cool about Kendrick is that, yeah, he's in Hollywood, but he is a community leader, and you seldom see that intersection in Hollywood. You know, usually it's a, you know, they slap a celebrity on the face of a cause and that's it. But we actually see Kendrick doing the work, and it shows, and like, you could tell he's passionate about it, and he's so knowledgeable, and he has like good advice if you guys want to get involved, or just like even just taking care of yourself, or, you know, just being involved in like helping create change. And I love how, you know, we talk about community in general and how like that is important. And of course we talk a little bit about Insecure.
We try to get some tea on season 5. You guys can listen of how successful we were. But he's just doing good work. He has this organization called Build Power that, you know, he's trying to empower and implement change within marginalized groups. He's just a really interesting guy. And yeah, he said he's from Texas, so this was a nice little Texas native
Texas episode where we could talk freely.
Without further ado, here is Kendrick. Well, Kendrick, welcome to Deadline's New Hollywood Podcast. We are very happy to have you on here, especially because you are a Texas native. Like,
yes, Texas.
We're repping Texas today on the podcast.
Wait. So you're long? Did you go to UT?
No. He's from Houston. He's from Houston. Yes.
I used to go to Houston a lot because I went to A&M and all my friends were in Houston, and I would go to Houston every single weekend, and they're all still there, by the way.
There was nothing to do in College Station, so
no, there wasn't. There wasn't.
Yeah, that was a pass through on my way to grandma's house.
But like I said, welcome.
This one is UT.
That one. There's a difference?
Houston.
That's—
yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. How did I not know this?
You know, Beyonce doesn't throw up UT.
No. It would be cool if she did, though. But anyway, so Kendrick, we like to start off this conversation by just getting a few, just going through your background, learning about, you know, what sparked your interest in this crazy, crazy business, like we call entertainment. So for you, I mean, obviously we've seen you in Insecure, you've been on How to Get Away with Murder. We've seen you in so many things. Miss Juneteenth, which is a great film if you guys haven't seen it. Nicole Beharie, who you star, it's a great film. Anyways, but for you, where did this all start for you? Who was your inspiration, and what really sparked your interest in this business?
Man, back in the day, it was just, I used to see movies with Will Smith and Fresh Prince and, you know, Denzel Washington, and watched other movies with Sidney Poitier. And even back then it was Robin Williams and Jack Nicholson. And my dad was a big movie guy. So was my mom, really. But everybody did music in my family. They didn't do it professionally. They were in some business or another, you know, something else. You know, art was like hobbies. When I got to middle school, I found out, because I used to grow up doing impressions and stuff like that and creating these little characters, you know, that you would play with in the corner, my hands or whatever, and do... and my family would always ask me to do impressions and tell stories. So I grew up being a storyteller, but I didn't know people got paid for it. You know, I didn't put that together until I saw this theater program at my school, and I got to play, I think, an Australian character or something like that. And then I saw, like, I made the connection. I'm like, wait, kids are doing this. I saw commercials and stuff like, I'm like, wait, kids are doing this on TV and I could do that. I mean, worst case scenario, I could jump on a trampoline and say, fall into the gap, right? Or something, you know, I'm like, I can do that.
Yeah.
My mom gave me a newspaper. I told her I wanted to do it. I was, I think, 10, 11 at the time. And my mom is a hustler. She works her butt off. Y'all know some curse words are gonna come out, but I'm okay.
No. You could say anything here. This is a safe space.
But yeah, she gave me a newspaper. I looked for an agent and in the newspaper in Houston, and
wow.
And found one. And then they called my mom like, is your son supposed to be calling us? Is he have his approval? Like, your approval?
You were calling these agents yourself as a 10-year-old?
Yeah.
Oh!
Keep in mind, my mom had us in like Excel classes in the third, right? So she was trying to gear us for business world and to be like independent and such, and she was single. So it kind of backfired because I am very diligent and independent, but for the arts, right? which there's a whole business to as well. But yeah. And then, you know, I met a bunch of people through acting class. I didn't ever stop training. Mm-hmm. And I knew there were a bunch of rich white kids out there that were going to LA for a pilot season and like, coming back with these stories. And my mom was like, I ain't quitting my job so you could go to some for months to do a hobby. So when I turned 18, I moved to LA.
Oh, wow.
So said, wow. When you're grown, you could do whatever you want. Until right. then, you're under my roof. You know the whole story. And yep. I said, all right, I'm grown.
So when you moved to LA when you were 18, I mean, everybody has a rough start in this. Everybody has a rough journey in this business, but especially for people of color, it could be a little bit more, and I'm being sarcastic, but a little bit more challenging. So can you talk about your experience when you first got to LA and you were in this acting business? What kind of roles were you going out for, or what kind of roles were you getting?
So in Houston, very few roles would come to LA, I mean, to Houston, period, but also even fewer for Black kids, right? And I couldn't really find Black teachers. And so the first thing I did when I got to LA, I was like, I want a Black teacher. I want, you know, some Black men in my life to mentor me. I want to be around Black people. I was literally like, where are my people? And a large reason I moved is so that I had more opportunity. And I didn't like a lot of the stuff that I would see that would finally come my way. I was turning down stuff when I was like in high school, because I was like, this is offensive. I think it perpetuates negative stereotypes. And so when I got here, I found Roby Theater Company, which was Black owned through this amazing woman, Marilyn, Marilyn Bobian. And that was introduced me to Paul Robeson, right? Mm-hmm. Amazing mm-hmm. activist, socialist, like incredible dude, right? And then I found Richard Lyons, I found Troy Rowland, I found Dustin Felder was actually the first, you know, rest in peace. They introduced me to all of their friends and would, I mean, like feed me, and I was broke as hell. and give me the inside scoop on what I need to be focusing on. Actually, our first role, Anna Jope, who moved from Houston as well.
Love her.
We got to Richard's class together, Richard Lyons' class together, and he gave us, the first scene he gave us was Betty Shabazz and Malcolm X. But in order to do it, the first time he was like, this ain't it. And so he made me read the Malcolm X autobiography. So there was a lot of like synergy to on my way to activism as well. That informed my art, because our existence is inherently political, right? So it was really, I had a really incredible introduction and was surrounded by a good community of folks. Mostly Black women, to be honest, that just surrounded me and nurtured me, and I'm forever indebted.
Yeah, well, you mentioned, like, you kind of are going into our, like, what we're going to talk about next, about your passion for advocacy and activism, and how that intersects with, you know, yourself as a creator, as an actor. But you mentioned, you know, the people when you first moved here into LA, you know, you found kind of your, as they say, you know, your group, your tribe, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But like, where did kind of this passion for advocacy and activism even come from? Like, did you feel it even before you came to LA? Like, how did this kind of just develop in your soul?
Yeah. I mean, I always had a pull towards being right. And I always say God turned it against me. Like, I wanted to be right all the time, and I learned, you know, through many different people and reading and whatever, that in order to be right, you have to admit when you're wrong. What, you know, there's a difference from being right and doing right. And just, you know, the more I went on through life and sought that, what is the best way to do right and be right, and what's the difference and all that kind of stuff, it just led me, to be honest, to activism. That's the simplest way to say it. Mm-hmm. But there were all of these other things that informed me. Like, my dad grew up orphaned and, you know, had a hard life, went to Vietnam, grew up in the boonies. In Louisiana. Both my parents were super poor, used to make their own clothes and would remind us often whenever we wanted any clothes, how they made their own clothes and we should be grateful. and would encourage us to make our own as well, which I was always like, well, you didn't want to, why would you want to? But yeah, I mean, you know, had a good work ethic instilled in me, and my own experiences, you know, getting harassed by police growing up, or a lot of what I saw portrayed in TV and in film led me to doing what I was, fighting for better, right? And like I started hanging with like this Colombian girl and this other Mexican girl and this Black and Anna Jope and a bunch of folks, the Palestinian girl, and just being like, where are our roles? And we would be in class, we would be in these classes with all these white people that were working, and they weren't great. Like we were like, we had to be like without ego, like for real, yeah. Without ego, even if it's just like that we had more time to work on it because we had no job, we were like, we could pull that shit off, right? They're not better than us, but they're working all the time. What's the deal here? So we tried to start writing stuff together and producing stuff. And it was just, you know, we realized we had to fight. And there was a fight that needed to be had in the streets and in the boardrooms and in the casting rooms and the questions we were being asked and all that. So we did it. And I started trying to produce stuff and write and I also started working that first year. I met a pastor from Houston, Frank Wilson, rest in peace as well. And I moved in with Mama, who is like my grandma. I mean, y'all from Texas, grandma.
For those who are, for the listening people,
But she wasn't biological. But, I was blessed with these people around me, and this pastor talked about, you know, it was Christmas. He was like, you know, how would y'all feel if people came to y'all's birthday and started asking for presents? Mm-hmm. Well, that's what y'all do on Christmas. It's supposed to be, y'all talking about y'all celebrating Jesus's birthday, but y'all around here asking for presents. So that, that Christmas he made us, he asked us to forego presents and go to the homeless shelter. And I was introduced to the homeless shelters here, and I became obsessed with the way it the humility that it brought, and saw a lot of the mental health problems that exist in my family, and how I was like one step away from, you know, being one of these people that have no home. As a matter of fact, in 2007, I think, I had no home for a while. Before I moved in with Mama, I was sleeping either in my car or on somebody's couch or wherever I could, you know. So it gave me a passion looking at the different aspects of why people were there.
Right.
The real reasons as to why people were there and how they're criminalized that really led to my activism in LA. Mm-hmm.
It laid the foundation. So like, where did, was there one particular moment or a collection of moments that made you want to launch Build Power? You know, because this group is like amazing. What do you guys do? Like, was there like a turning point where like, oh man, I need to launch something because I need to do this? Or like, what was there like a watershed moment, or was it just kind of organic?
It was more organic. It was a long process. It was years and years of trying to get other people. So from that homeless shelter, I started throwing my birthdays there because I realized it was really hard to get Hollywood folks to come. And so I started throwing my birthdays there because then people, instead of giving me presents, they would give me donation. And that created a tradition on my birthday and on Christmas, of just getting people to come with me. Thanksgiving, everybody was there anyway, and there were like too many people trying to get their feel good moment of the year. But I was like, on these others, it's empty. And so let's let's participate in that. And then, you know, still that I realized the difference between charity and activism. Charity wasn't getting to the root of it. It was a Band-Aid, right? And I was just like, how do we get to the root of it? How do we? And eventually through Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown and really trying to figure out what to do and how to get out in the streets and how to change things, I found the Black Lives Matter movement and Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and other dope radical folks through that and through activism. And getting Hollywood to involved back then, oh my God.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. It was like, you know, everybody was worried about PR. I was too, I'm not gonna lie. I was like, I might not have a career after this. But we did our best. I even, you know, back then, they might not, I'm like, should I say this? But I think there's a couple people I can mention that I know, like Cedric the Entertainer, Megan Good, Steve Jones. There were a few of us that were like, let's create this organization or nonprofit that helps us organize specifically Black Hollywood back then, but Hollywood in general. That was our first attempt, right? and it was interesting. And there were other, you know, and all of us are still working on that in some way, right? Mm-hmm. And I still talk to Megan all the time and Steve, and there, and just there's, I started finding people, like-minded people, and over time found Mike De La Rocha and Tia Osho through activism and, you know, campaigning for Bernie Sanders and all of these other politicians and, you know, finding our place and again, trying to activate Hollywood. And we eventually came together and said, let's streamline this. We've learned from our mistakes. We've all had different trial and errors and let's get some money together and hopefully get some programming around this. And that's how Build Power came together.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Let me ask you, so, you know, obviously over the summer after the murder of George Floyd, and you know, the mobilization of Black Lives Matter, it did seem like a lot of these bigger companies, Nike, I think, was Nike, some of these agencies, everybody came out to support Black Lives Matter. and it seems like, you know, this, you know, 2020, the murder of George Floyd sort of shifted perspectives a little bit. It did feel like people sort of started seeing what we have been saying when we say Black Lives Matter, right? you're your face right now. So I wanna ask you, do you think that with what happened, I mean, I know obviously things happen very slowly in this, and something like racism, institutional racism, is not going to clear up in a week or a year or whatever. But do you think that that we're going to get some meaningful change from Hollywood after everything that happened after the summer? Because it did seem like people were finally on board, coming out with a bunch of initiatives to increase diversity. I know some of the agencies increased pay for their interns and had initiatives to bring more interns of color. So what do you think about it? What do you think about it?
Yeah, yeah. Simon and Schuster. There's a lot of, I'm gonna be completely honest with you. I thought it was bullshit. I think it's bullshit now. Mm-hmm. I know that most companies, all companies really, especially in Hollywood, operate in this hyper capitalism ideology and philosophy. And diversity and inclusion comes from a place of liability, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody putting hashtag Black Lives Matter on their social media and their buildings was in hopes that people wouldn't burn their shit down too, right? Mm. And a lot of the, let's be real, internships and assistant was in response, like the emboldenment around support for internships and assistance was around lawsuits and organizing. Assistants being like, I'm done, I'm fed up, right? A lot of it was in response to demands put out by folks, right?
Right.
And what I saw was a lot of people, a lot of companies, figuring out how, again, how to not get burnt down, and making promises and then stalling on those promises until they figured out who was going to be in office. Mm-hmm. They were hoping that's my personal experience. Mm-hmm. 'Cause they were hoping we get Trump out and that means everybody we can all go back to normal.
Racism talk.
Racism's done.
Post some panels. We gave some people some jobs. It's fine. We gave some overall deals. We don't actually have to honor them. That's what I mean. I'm just saying. Yeah. This is nothing new.
It's not.
Certain things happen. Mm-hmm. This is cyclical. It was like after Rodney King.
Right.
A lot of, black entertainment was on TV, but they were under-resourced and undervalued. And there was a surge in the 70s after civil rights. There was
You've seen this before, yeah.
So, I'm always like, where's the proof, right? That's why we said prove Black Lives Matter to Hollywood, because we wanted to see proof. Mm-hmm. And while I have seen things happen, people have brought in diversity and inclusion consultants and
multicultural, they've all like multicultural units.
Yeah. But have I seen any actual change come? I've seen a lot of shifting. I've seen a lot of Black people being hired and then the Black people that were there or the people of color that were there leaving for new opportunities because they're like, y'all had y'all's chance to change this shit. I don't believe y'all hiring a couple new Black folks is gonna actually do anything. So they go to another one. I'm just saying, you know,
you're about to burst. Dino's about to explode.
No. It's a whole other conversation, but.
Yes, yeah. Going.
Sorry, Kendrick. I'm sorry if I'm being.
I know everybody's experiencing it. Yeah. So it's just, it is what it is, Yeah. And I don't trust it because the model hasn't changed.
Right.
In order to, I think, I'm gonna mess up her name, but I think it's Malaika Jalabi, who was saying like, if you address the material needs of Black people, if you actually address the material needs of Black people, it would upend capitalism. And so they give us hyper visibility instead and hope that we will settle for it, right? They don't actually want to change the systems. They don't want to change power. I don't see any
power. I was going to ask you, do you think, because obviously the real change is the power, right? Like who's in charge and who is the power? Yeah. It seems like there's initiatives to, we're going to pledge to, make 10 films by people of color or to make all these things.
Or whatever, yeah.
But it's like, are we making pledges to bring some color to the boardroom? Are we making pledges to bring some color to the C-suite or bring some equity to the C-suite? I haven't really heard about stuff like that, because that's. Yeah.
And also who are we bringing? Because, it's not just about colorful faces in white spaces high places, right? It's about an ideological shift as well. It's about moving on from diversity inclusion, aka liability, right? Moving beyond diversity inclusion into liberation, which means you got to get your hands dirty, which means you do have to be political, right? Which means you do have to shift power and decentralize white supremacy, which is white people, translates to in Hollywood, to white people making the decisions over which of our stories get told and how they get told. We do not have autonomy over our storytelling, and that lens I've seen even in recruiting right now, right? In recruiting, there are blocks, inherent blocks to people of color and people of different identities, especially Black people, in where they're recruiting, where they're finding their people, the criteria that they're using, that it's impossible with, I'm not gonna say impossible, but it's impossible to have a wide net of people to choose from that look like me and y'all, right? If we're being suspended from school at higher rates, if we're being locked up, our genius is in HBCUs and college campuses, but not just there, right? Our genius is confined to that. It's also in juvenile detention centers and in prisons and on the streets and houseless communities, in the detention rooms at schools, and just there's so many places that we are excluded from because we have touched the American legal system, or we're deemed, our communication is deemed dangerous or inadequate or whatever, right? The way that we talk, the way that we move. And so we need to change the criteria, and the pipelines can't just come from institutions built for white supremacy. Education and such. So anyway, I can go on forever.
It's all like true.
Right. Yeah.
It's so true.
But I think more than anything, like you said, Amanda, it is a power shift in those spaces, in the highest spaces. And I've seen it even in like creatively white people. I had to give up on some projects because I realized, I just do my best to assess, people are like, hey, we'd love for you to produce this and star in it. And I'm like, that's an amazing opportunity. This is incredible. Who else is coming to me? But why are all these people white? And if you can't as a white person properly inform this project with Black leads, you don't know that it fundamentally shifts what this story is and what this world is that you want to present to people, and how are you bringing in other people? And I realize in bringing in Black people in the same way in C-suites and such, and why it's not happening as quickly as we want to, is because they're afraid not only of our skin color and our genders and such, but they're also afraid of our ideologies and liberation.
And they
want to find a way to find Black people or people of color, brown folks, that will not threaten white supremacy and will not threaten their own power.
Yeah, that's it.
God, that's it. That's the end of the podcast. We're done.
This episode is brought to you by Lifetime's Robin Roberts Presents Mahalia. From executive producers Robin Roberts and Linda Berman comes the biopic of the legendary Mahalia Jackson. Grammy Award winner Danielle Brooks stars as the trailblazer whose music moved, inspired, and changed people's hearts. Critics have praised Brooks's transformative performance into the Queen of Gospel as thunderingly good. Directed by Kenny Leone and written by Bettina Jilliwa and Todd Kreidler, this Lifetime original movie continues to inspire viewers and highlights the ongoing fight for social justice. Robin Roberts presents Mahalia for your Emmy consideration in all categories.
No, it's like everything you said is like, I have so many things to say, and I was thinking throughout like my own experiences, and kind of, you know, you hit the nail on the head, and just like everything's a checkbox, everything's a token, you know, change needs to happen from the top down, but like that top refuses to let go of their positions. Cause like when we talked to David Oyelowo, and like, why should they? Because this system was built for them. So they're gonna try to just stay at the top. And then when we try to build our own door, they're like, oh, no, you can't do that. And they're like, oh, why can't we play with y'all? And then it just becomes this whole mess, and I'm over it.
And you know,
Amanda Orgenting.
Yeah, I can't wait for the day that, you know, I don't know if it's ever gonna happen, but to see that sort of maybe like people really addressing that. Addressing, you know, the especially like white men. Are they ever going to address that? Are we ever going to see that? So I don't know. It's one of these things where when I see these changes happen, I do get excited that like people are paying attention. But yeah, I do feel like a lot of it is performative too. I've seen a lot of performance going on, you know. So it's just one of these. I don't know how do you keep going in your activism? This is really exhausting. You know, even us talking, we talk about this stuff all the time, and it's like, is there ever going to be a change? Are we really just, you know, saying these things and you know, people are hearing it, but is there actually going to be something, any action happening? I feel like it doesn't seem like it. So for you, what's your motivation to keep going? Not just with like activism within the industry, but activism within, you know, the Black community, addressing police brutality, I mean, you were out there during the George Floyd protest. You were very vocal about it. There's been a lot of stuff going on recently with police brutality. When it comes to be honest, it is exhausting. It is exhausting to listen to it. It is emotional. I can't even talk about it as much anymore because it just really it really can bring somebody's spirits down. But you sort of deal with this every single day. So what is your motive? How do you keep going? How do you keep motivating yourself to keep going?
So I think, an abolitionist ideology is key, right? And understanding that it's not reform that will bring us places, that reform usually emboldens the institutions, right? It gives them, it's like, oh, then we need more money to do this or whatever so that we can be better. But what it is, understanding that these systems are so deeply rooted and we have to focus on those roots. We have to uproot the tree that a bad seed, my favorite way of describing it, a bad seed produces a bad tree, produces bad fruit. A good seed produces a good tree, produces good fruit. I grew up in church. That's where, you know? But you have to uproot the tree, right? It's always gonna produce bad fruit. Like policing. Policing was born out of slave catching and will always operate that way. Prisons will always operate as a continuation of slavery under the guise of the 13th Amendment, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the whole movie 13th is about, right? And so uproot them and plant new seeds of care and peace and nourishment. And you have to have a foundation that the roots have to be, the seed had to be, right? Mm-hmm. And it will always bear good fruit. If that was his intention, if we build it well with a strong foundation, that I practice I do my best to practice in my interpersonal relationships, in myself. I meditate every day and visualize what that world looks like with no cops, right? And what we have to do in order to get there, right? How do I think about who's the most vulnerable among my friends, right? Among my family, and work to know if they have a mental health episode, what is our plan, right? That's the system that's gonna replace police coming in. You get what I'm saying? It starts with us having those conversations, and visualizing that world keeps me moving forward. Also, what keeps me moving forward is seeing kids in LA defund school police by 35%. Shout out to LA Students Deserve and Black Lives Matter Youth Vanguard. Being a part of passing Measure J, being a part of holding folks accountable for Measure J when they decide that they're not gonna spend the amount of money that they said that they were gonna spend, right? Seeing New Mexico in qualified immunity, New York City Council vote to end qualified immunity. These are things, seeing whole police departments dismantled and abolished, that is something that literally for the past 5 years or whatever, people, like the most radical folks, were saying it's just not gonna happen because of what we have in place. And it's happening, right? Mm-hmm. On set the other day, I've been on a few sets, but I've, and it's been interesting. We still use cops, right? We still use cops in Hollywood. If we're thinking about where we need cops the least, why do we have them at our performances, at events in Hollywood on our sets? And one of them had a Blue Lives Matter license plate and a Blue Lives Matter hat. And I said, I talked to the producer, one of the producers who's been super supportive. And he was like, I said, I think he needs to go. And he was like, done. Mm-hmm. And he was like, and I'm gonna raise hell because we don't need these police on set. He was like, there's no reason. The only reason we have them is because we have to. And I've told them that we wanna move on this since last year and they have not responded. So I'm gonna light a fire under their ass. Mm-hmm. This is not something that would have happened a year ago, right? I would have been like, we got to move him. And maybe they would have been like, I don't know. I don't want to shake and ruffle anything. Right? But that's the type of stuff that keeps me going. Seeing people organizing around, people fed up, and people actually open to the idea that it is the entire system. Mm-hmm. It is the entire system, and we need a new system. And people not being less afraid to talk about that. We need more people to talk about it unapologetically. Yeah. But I would say those are my two things that keep me going, is meditation and visualization, and then the wins.
Right.
The wins that they try to diminish. I ain't gonna lie, it's exhausting. With all the resources I have more resources than most people in my community to be well. Than most of the people in my community to be well, and in my family, more than anybody really in my family. And I still get depressed.
Yeah.
I still am exhausted and tired and at times super anxious. I have pretty severe anxiety. And so I'm not saying it's easy, but that's what keeps me going.
Yeah. Going to that, because, you know, activism, you know, I think all communities of color, you know, the Black community, Latinx, and like, especially now, I'm very active with the Asian community, with what's going on there. And, you know, I try to give love to all communities, obviously, and that's a lot. But, you know, when it comes to activism, there's a lot of like these misconceptions, like so many people, including myself, sometimes I feel guilty for not being able to go to a rally or go to a, you know, to show up. It's like, oh, if I don't do this, you know, it feels like I'm not, you know, supporting, or, you know, then that's when you spread yourself thin, and then you're just like, you know, I'm useless. But, you know, excuse me. But what are things you think people can like genuinely do? I mean, you probably get asked this a lot, but, you know, I think this platform is a great way to kind of voice this. Like, what things can people do that could actually genuinely help the cause instead of, you know, being performative or virtue signaling or all of that. Because I think right now, a lot of people feel helpless. You know, like some people can't go out and march, some people can't do this, or they really don't do social media or whatever. But, you know, what do you say to people who can't really, who feel helpless in moments like these?
I think a lot of people feel helpless. One, because it's constant and it's a drain on our mental health. Two, because we're always taught individualist ideologies, right? That is the American way, to be completely frank. And it's divisive. It keeps us from organizing together and thinking about the collective at all times, right? And so getting out of that, getting your mind out of that, that's part of my meditation every day, is making sure that I'm always thinking about the collective. Because I was even looking at this monologue that I have to perform, and it was very much like centered around getting to the top, and it's lonely at the top, and you have to shed your community sometimes. Everybody can't come with you. It's the things that we've heard over and over again. But that's not really power. Power, that's hierarchical. That's wealth building. That's, you know, capitalism, right? Mm-mm. Power is an ecosystem. Power is together. Power is in the collective. Mm-hmm. That is organizing together. That's how you, within institutions, because we all always have to be thinking about liberation wherever we are. We always have to be thinking about liberation. And I always think about it through the lens of abolition, uprooting and building new systems. So in order to do that together, we have to have these conversations. Like I said, you know, if somebody's suffering from addiction, how do we surround them, support them, and love them, and not turn them over to the American legal system, right? How do we create systems to take care of our folks if there's something problematic happening, domestic abuse or harassment in the workplace or white supremacy, right? That we see every day in the workplace, pay problems, whatever. How do we organize around it, find other like-minded people? Because I wouldn't have gotten through last year if it wasn't for a community that I've built over the past 5 or 6 or longer. I've been doing my best to think about, again, through a lens of abolition, how to build strong community, interpersonal relationships, how to uproot the bad habits and toxic culture that hinders relationship building, that keeps us from being well. And I build community as best as I can around that with all the shit that we got to deal with. And I think we have to do that. That's what keeps us going. I wouldn't have been able to do it without community. It's not an individual practice. It's not just going to therapy. That is a very important one. But our mental health has to do with job security. Our mental health has to do with nourishment, exercise, sunlight, especially for people that have darker skin, okay? We need to kiss our melanin, right? And so there is so much that has to do with taking care of each other, interpersonal relationships. But that's most important, I believe.
I love that. I love how you said about, you know, community, because I think that's paramount. Like, you know, just kind of having someone to have your back is always nice, and having people to advocate for you is always good.
Yeah. So obviously we can't end this podcast without asking you about here. Let's look here a little bit. Season 5, obviously, we now know is going to be the final season. Is there anything that you can tell us about what to expect?
Can you just tell us everything?
Well,
who's it gonna end up with? No, I'm just
kidding. I don't know. Two, okay. That's just the truth. But two, pivot, that is actually a really great example of some beautiful community. Yeah. Because a lot of people say, a lot of people, I've had people be like, well, you know, it's easy because you're on a set with a bunch of Black people. And I'm like, I've been on projects with Black people that didn't support each other. Mm-hmm. It's not just a given that we all think alike, right? And that we all are gonna get along. We are not a monolith. We think differently. We come from different places. But I personally, my experience has been supported. Even when I disagree with folks, I feel supported and I feel privileged to be there and to be a part of history. And this fifth season is going to be historic and dope.
God, I can't wait.
It's going to be that type of entertainment that we need after a couple of tough years or
okay.
2020, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, it's gonna be really incredible. I think it's gonna be fun.
That's all you could say.
We get it. I can't wait. I mean, the show always touches on topics, so I just can't wait to see what you guys have in store for this season, and hopefully for the movie. I'm just kidding.
We've had so many insecure guests on. Natasha Hodge or Alexander Hodge, and now you. It's like,
all of them have. Alex did something for our Liberate Mental Health. He did a IG live with their name wrong, Basi Ikpe. And talked about mental health and bipolar, the experience of bipolar disorder. And then, Issa and Natasha have been super, super, super supportive in the streets and behind the scenes.
Love Tasha's and Natasha's. Greg Abbott, or not Greg Abbott.
Kemp.
Yeah. She did it with Trump. I like every single time every time she.
Yeah, me too. It's like, just like all, it reminds you, like, oh yeah, he is trash.
Like when she's committed, like she is committed.
with comedy, but it's serious, right?
Yeah.
I think that it's incredible. I've learned so much being there. They're a great model for how, if we're looking at, I'm not saying that they're coming from an abolitionist lens, I'm not speaking from them, but I have learned and seen through this community project how to touch all aspects, how to invest in the community, right, in South LA,
right,
how to employ people that need employment, including formerly incarcerated folks, how to employ and support creatives, Black creatives, and actors, and just, and then be outspoken and be dope. Yeah. So.
I love that.
I know.
A way to, we like to end these interviews is a segment we call the FACTS or the FAQs. So just random questions that we like to ask. Your first question is, what is one restaurant from Texas that you miss the most?
I was gonna say, I used to go when on special occasions, I used to go to Brennan's. I like Creole food. I love Creole food, but there's a turkey leg hut too. Ooh. That's like stuffed turkey legs.
I haven't had a
gluttonous. But it's incredible. And it's like a block party outside, and it's Black owned and it's dope.
Yes.
Wait, where in Houston are you from?
I'm from Mo City. So
I grew up. Oh, Missouri City. Okay.
and I grew up like on the Southwest side and then Mo City. I would go to school and literally lived on my street. You could do like this. You could like straddle the middle of the street and you were either in Houston or Mo City.
Oh, nice.
Dope. Cool. What was the series you most recently binged? What is the most recent series you binged watched?
A Different World.
Oh, dope!
I need to rewatch A Different World.
I literally finished it last night.
Oh, nice.
It's interesting watching it now, huh? Like, it's really interesting. It's so interesting.
And seeing a lot of like what's happening now.
Still happening, right? Yeah. Mm. That's what I watched Living Single. I was binging Living Single. And I was like, so many relevant things in this movie. I mean, in the show. Okay. Yep. If you could erase one event from history, what would it be?
One only.
Only one event.
Shit, I don't know. I guess colonization? I don't know.
That's a good one. That's the only one.
I would definitely erase Trump from being president. I think that's what I because
because
I hate him. Anyway, go ahead, Dina.
Kendrick, what is the weirdest thing in your refrigerator?
Probably, I ain't really got much in there. I had some old.
Wait, that's the weird part for me.
Yeah, I had some old aloe vera. I think,
Speaking of weird, I just recently learned that people don't put ketchup in the fridge, and apparently that's weird that people, because I put ketchup in the fridge. I think that's where it belongs. But apparently that's weird. I didn't know that. I thought everybody did, but I recently learned on social media that's not common.
Yeah, I feel like
I
don't know is weird. Like I put peanut butter in the fridge.
I did
too.
Yeah, like peanut butter, jam, jelly.
It says keep refrigerated.
Some people don't put their eggs in the fridge. Some people don't put eggs in fridge. Some people don't put their butter in the fridge. It's
weird.
Weird,
yeah. Okay, next question.
It's the same people who don't wash their legs. So there you go.
Okay. If we asked your family and close friends, what's your worst habit, what would they say?
Worst habit? Probably, I'll say there's a couple of my buddies that hate. I have a compulsion. I really cannot help it. Mm-hmm. That I correct people's pronunciation and grammar under my breath.
Oh yeah, that's it. I can see how that's going to be.
I don't ever really hear it or whatever, and I might just mouth it or whatever. It's just like don't step on the crack kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's just like it'll come out. I'm hoping nobody sees me or hears it or whatever. Sometimes it's like completely involuntary. And I have a couple buddies that are like, fuck you. Because they catch it.
Yeah, I can definitely see how that's annoying. Dina, are you frozen?
I think Dino's frozen.
I think he's frozen. Okay, so I'll ask the last question since Dino is frozen. So we asked this to all our guests. Is there an underrepresented voice, whether it be an actor, writer, producer, anybody in the entertainment industry that is not maybe mainstream or maybe not a lot of people know about them, but deserve more shine?
There's a lot of them. I love Chinonye Chukwu. I think Child is a director that is really incredible, doing some music videos and different projects. There's a lot of them. I love, and then I want to shout out all my people. I'm like, Fabiana Rodriguez, she has some incredible art, and Yeah, there's a bunch of, I don't know, there's so many.
Yeah, I mean, we just, yeah, that's a good list. I just want, you know, just giving a shout out to people that, like I said, they're doing dope things. Maybe we haven't heard of them yet, but we'll hopefully be hearing from them soon.
If you haven't seen Random Acts of Flyness, Terrence Nance, and that whole team is incredible. Yeah.
Yes.
So, sorry.
Welcome back, Kate.
Like, my internet just went out. Like, literally, it just went out.
It looked like you were about to say something, but then you're just kind of sitting here, sort of like, is he frozen or is he going to say something?
What were we talking about before I left again?
Well, I just did the last question because.
Okay.
We're frozen.
Because I was like all rude and left.
It looked like you were like, I didn't like your answer.
Oh, no. No, what I was going to say is like, oh, I could totally picture that because I think I may do that as well. What you were saying about worst habits when like you correct people's grammar and when someone's like, all to who, and you're all to whom, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I do it super whisper, like, I'm like, fuck.
You're like, damn, I did it again.
Yeah.
That's okay. People should know correct grammar anyway. Grammar's
better. No, they should. And I'm a journalist and my grammar is trash.
Mine is.
It's like,
well, here's where I'm so hypocritical. I like purposefully betraying grammar. Like, and here's why. I found it in Spanish, and I'm gonna do my best to keep this short. So in Spanish, there's like, you know, people talk about Mexican Spanish and Puerto Rican Spanish and all of this, right? And they're like, they'll always tell you if you wanna get better with your Spanish to go to places that are closest to Spain, right? And then I always am like, but Spain's the colonizer, right? And I'm like, who wants to sound like the colonizer? I don't want to go to the hood and be like, hello, how are you? Like, you know, and try to help folks out, like, you know, kick me out. And so I gained an appreciation for the indigenous folks of Latin America and Black folks in Latin America making the language their own, right? With their own inflections, their own, like, I compare Caribbean Spanish, especially like Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico to like Atlanta, right? Because they leave out syllables. It's like, you know, learning English and talking to the Migos or something, right? And I gained an appreciation through that for my own people and how we talk and our inflections and the African, you know, sounds and such that we incorporate. And I love it. I fell more and more in love with that because fuck the colonizers.
That's the perfect way to end.
And on that note, let's end this. Kendrick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Kendrick.
This was great. I loved it, guys.
Yeah.
This
is probably one of my #FTDC. Fuck the colonizers.
Yes.